What's up, everyone? I'm Andrew Steinwald, and this is Zima Red. On this show, we speak with the users, founders, and creatives that are diving into the world of unique digital assets, also called non-fungible tokens.
Andrew Steinwald is the managing partner of Sifirmion, an investment firm focused on the NFT ecosystem. All opinions expressed by Andrew and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Sifirmion. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Sifirmion or related entities may maintain positions in the assets discussed in this podcast.
My guest today is Nick Kokonis. Nick is a modern-day Renaissance man. Formerly a successful trader, he's a founder of multiple Michelin star restaurants and also a tech founder, having recently sold his startup for $400 million. On this episode, we discuss his incredible success as a trader, creating multiple Michelin star restaurants, being a startup founder, selling his company to Squarespace, his thoughts on crypto, how NFTs will change the world, and so much more. This is one you do not want to miss. Please enjoy my conversation with Nick. Nick, thank you so much for joining me today. Super excited to chat with you. And to get us started, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background. And before doing that, you know, I was diving deep into your background, of course, and I honestly think you might be the Dos Equis man. Like, I think you are the most interesting man in the world. So I'm really excited about this. So take it away. I'd love to hear all about it.
Great to be here, Andrew. I've got a weird background. I studied philosophy in college. I got there thinking I would study econ or something like that, something quote unquote practical. And I had a wonderful professor in Intro to Logic, who was at one point the longest tenured professor in America, Jerome Balmuth, who passed away a few years back at Colgate. And he pulled me aside and basically said, I'm going to teach you how to think, and I'm going to get your money out of this college experience. And he drove me really hard for 4 years to learn how to write, how to synthesize ideas, how to analyze texts. Like, he was a great professor, and the school was wonderful for me. And when I got out, I had gotten into law school, but never wanted to practice law. And so I lasted literally like a day and went, this is not what I should be doing. And I kind of floundered around for a bit and found myself really attracted to the markets. And back then that meant floor trading, because that's where options and derivatives, futures, were traded. And I'm from Chicago. So if you're from Chicago, you know folks who did that, because back then it was probably employed 40,000 traders. I mean, a lot of people. And I went down there, took a $5 an hour job just to see the place, and learned options from another mentor. And I was a derivatives trader for 12 years. It's not that dissimilar to the crypto markets and NFTs and all of that, because the values are derived from, thus the word derivatives, from the value of other commodities, hard and soft. And some of them are conceptual. So I did that for a dozen years. And merged with a company in New York, and then basically burnt out just working my tail off. And it was very physical work back then. You know, you were on the trading floor for 10 hours a day, you know, yelling and screaming. And I loved it. I did very well at it. And after I sort of took a hiatus, it turned out I never went back, but I didn't know that at the time. I met Chef Grant Achatz, and he was kind of similar to the people that I wanted to hire as a trader. And basically, you know, the first restaurant I built was Alinea in Chicago, which now is a Michelin 3-star restaurant. And that was a very circuitous journey, because Grant got very, very sick a couple of years into it. He had stage 4 cancer. And that's the point at which I went into the restaurant every single night and during the day, and really tried to understand the operations of the place more than just the person who set up the business and the architecture and did the accounting and all that. I started to have to sort of run it. And so I started building software for the restaurants that we built. And that turned into Tock, which now has about 250 employees. And it was really overlaying the value of time onto reservations and yield management for restaurants. So kind of a circuitous route through, that's the very fast version of things. And, you know, through it all, I had a love of technology and a love of programming when I was a kid. And so consequently, you know, have forever been fascinated by what's new, try to stay young, try to stay exposed to what's going to happen in the future. And, you know, always trying to find that thing that will look inevitable in hindsight. You know, the best ideas are the ones that, you know, 10 years into them, people go like, oh yeah, well, that's obvious. But at the time, it wasn't obvious at all. And so I think that's kind of where I try to place myself, both from a business and personal interest standpoint.
Amazing. Okay, so you've also actually written a book or two, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, I've done a few cookbooks as a collaborator and producer with an amazing couple, Alan and Sarah Hemberger, from Industrial Light and Magic and Pixar. They came to work for us. And then I wrote Life on the Line, which is the memoir of Grant Achatz, but actually has sort of stories from his life and mine. And I actually wrote both parts of that as well.
Wow. Okay, so, you know, trader, restaurateur, tech entrepreneur, author, like these are all very different, you know, kind of business domains. How are you going about that? When you're entering a new field or new domain, what are you targeting or what are you looking for to achieve success? And are you looking at, okay, what you know, how can I identify my edge here? Like, how is that process?
You know, I don't know. Other than I when I get very, very curious about a subject, I tend to not look to the experts on it. Not to say that I won't read, you know, a book about it or ask questions or read stuff on the internet or whatever, but I don't assume that the quote unquote experts are correct. You know, like if you read Wall Street analysts, one of the things that a lot of people have pointed out, but it occurred to me when I was very, very young as a trader is, man, if they knew what the hell they were talking about, they'd be trading. They wouldn't tell anyone. So anyone who's selling their advice, me included for that matter, probably doesn't know what the hell they're talking about. Because if they did, they would just do it themselves. So I always look to, like, who are the innovators that aren't talking about much? And what are they actually doing? You know, what do they do day to day? And then I just ask a lot of, like, what I call, like, fifth grade questions. You know, like, for the restaurants, it was as simple as, you know, we have a wait list of 50 people, but we have two empty tables today. Why? And the answer to that was just people didn't show up. You know, it's a really basic answer. But then you ask the question, like, well, what can we do about that? And when people say, like, well, nothing, we call to confirm or we hold a credit card and try to charge them afterwards or whatever, I instead went like, well, what happens if you do that in another form of entertainment? Like, if you no-show, if you buy tickets to Steppenwolf Theater and John Malkovich is there, so it's selling out, and you don't show up, guess what? They don't stop the play for you, right? They don't give you a refund. It's your fault you didn't show up. So I started looking at that and just applying these principles from other industries in a novel way to the industry I was involved in. And so I think that's what I've done a bit my whole life. Like on the trading floor, I noticed that a lot of the big banks had headsets on and they were talking to their bank trading desks. And meanwhile, we were doing arbitrage between the New York Amex, American Stock Exchange, where all the ETFs were singly listed back then, 98, 99. And the natural hedge for that was the futures pits in Chicago. But I didn't see anybody communicating directly with their trading desks. They were going through brokerages. And back then it was hand signals and there's probably like a 5-second delay on that hedge. So I was just like, well, is it legal to do that? Can I just like put on a headset and, you know, essentially have a hard line, you know, T1 line back then, open line of communication? And everyone told me no, but as it turns out, it was perfectly legal. So, you know, it was kind of like having a 5-second window on everyone else. Now, that is not much of an innovation from a technology standpoint, But it was like the most basic question, like, well, why are the banks doing it with currencies, but no one's doing it with the ETFs? And so that's it. Like, it's not hard. It's just a bit of a discipline to look around and be aware of what's going on. And then you have to be passionately curious and grind. It's a grind. Everything's a grind.
So is it fair to say that throughout your career, you've, you know, asked simple questions, obviously worked like crazy, and have you been looking towards technology in order to improve your functions in order to improve your business? Because with your trading career, clearly you were utilizing technology when other people weren't. And also with Alinea and your restaurants, you built Tock, which is this, you know, restaurant software. And so is that a fair thing to say, that you're looking towards technology in order to improve everything?
Yeah, I mean, look, information is in every business, and the organization of that information and the ability to leverage it in a way that is timely and easy is the art of it. You know, it's like, if you're in a busy environment like a trading floor, or you're in a busy environment where every day is showtime like a fine dining restaurant, you have to enable people through the technology, not just, you know, say, oh great, you know, here's a whole bunch of information, all the guests coming in, we're gonna make sure they have better service. So the way that you present and organize information is as important as having access to it, but it's critical to do both. And, you know, I've done it wrong in a lot of ways, a lot of times. And what I find is usually, like, the simplest thing is often the best. Like, I see a lot of tech platforms that want to go into restaurants with a lot of screens, but, you know, if every server is looking at a screen, it feels like they're not paying attention to guests. And so, you know, some things are better on paper, but organizing that and then getting it to them is part of the process of what we've built. And that's true also when you're selling things to guests. Like, you have to know what you're selling. You have to present it in a way which is easy to consume, understand, and then purchase. And there's a real art to all of that.
Yeah, you said before, you're like, you want to create things that are inevitable in hindsight. So how are you able to identify that on a repeated basis? Because you understood what was inevitable in hindsight in multiple different domains. So, like, how are you identifying that?
Yeah, I mean, I can only give an example. And, you know, that is that with my restaurant, I knew that the demand, and everybody knows this, right? Every restaurant in a big city in America that's decent is busy as heck on a Friday and Saturday night. Like, getting a reservation at 7 o'clock on a Saturday is definitely more difficult than getting a reservation on Tuesday at 7 p.m. Like, you'd agree to that, right?
Right.
Like, 100%. You know it. You just know it, right? Because of your experience. And yet, it's really, really weird that they're priced the same. Because usually when demand is very high or the seating is better, like, you know, one example I use is that if you're going to go to a baseball game, you're going to a Cubs game in Chicago here, if you're sitting on the third deck, last row, that ticket costs less than if you're sitting, you know, along the bench in this third row, you know, right along the third baseline. And nobody finds that surprising, because obviously one seat is better than another. And yet in the restaurant industry, people are trying to fill up their Tuesdays, but they price them the same as Saturdays. Why? Why is your haircut or your dentist priced the same on Saturday at 11 o'clock when everybody wants to go because they're not at work than it is on Tuesday at 11 o'clock? So, to me, you know, I can imagine the world where we're walking down the street and your phone is geofenced and the pricing is changing in almost real time, but locked to like some increment that the business wants. So if you're walking past a haircut place on a Tuesday, you know, it's gonna, and you're open to getting these ads or whatever, or it's the place you go to, why aren't they saying, hey, Andrew, your hair's probably getting long because you haven't been in here in 14 weeks. Hey, if you come on Tuesday, it's $20 less. That seems inevitable to me.
right? That small independent businesses, and especially service businesses, because service businesses are the human interactions that are probably not going to go away in the next 10 years. Like, it's unlikely that there's going to be a digital way to cut your actual hair soon, or a robot or whatever, except for the Flowbee, of course. So Flowbee aside, you know, that seems inevitable to me. And so if you start building that in small increments and giving those tools to businesses and proving an ROI on it for them, then you've probably hit upon something that's scalable and large.
So did you implement this variable pricing model in Tock?
Yeah, so it's not an automatic variable pricing model because a lot of people don't want to cede that control just yet. That's definitely something we're building in the future. But right now you can template days of the weeks and times of days and even experiences within a restaurant or within, you know, any number of different kind of service businesses that now use us. And, you know, if you go to Alinea on Tuesday night, it's $70 per person cheaper than Saturday night at 8 p.m.
Yeah, so you said that, you said other service businesses that are using Tock. So like if you own a barber, can you actually implement Tock and implement that variable pricing system in the future?
Yeah, so we're working to do other business types right now, because obviously they, like spas and whatnot, have slightly different needs than restaurants. But as an example that I never thought of when we built Tock, winery tasting rooms. We are by far the industry leader in winery tastings and tours in Napa, Sonoma, Washington State, et cetera. And, you know, it was interesting, about 5 years ago, Dariush Winery called us up and said, hey, we're looking at all the ticketing systems and booking systems because we have like a 30% no-show rate on people who book our tours and tastings. And, you know, it's costing us a ton of money because we're staffing it and a lot of people aren't showing up. And then some days we overbook it and then everyone shows up. And so as soon as I talked to them, like literally in the first 10 seconds, I was like, oh shit, I completely forgot about this. Like, I never saw it. I was building a thing for restaurants and I was very myopic in it. And suddenly, like, wineries. And so I was like, well, not only can you do that, but you can have three different kinds of tours. So you could have a free tasting to get people to try to buy wine on site. And then you can do like a reserve tasting, and then you can do your library tasting and tour with like the cellar tour with the winemaker and charge $500 a person for that, whatever you want. And instantly they were kind of laughing because they're like, this is what we've been looking for 2 years. And within a few months we had 50 wineries. Now we have about 1,500. And, you know, it's interesting because we took what was a loss leader at most of these wineries, the tours and tastings, and we made it so that it's a profit center for them. And it's a better experience for guests, because the guests that want to taste the great wines, or that want to talk to the winemaker, or want to spend time having a picnic at the winery and getting a couple bottles and bringing food in from outside, they can do all that now. And so if you go to exploretalk.com/wineries, it's a whole thing I didn't see myself when we were building Tock that now is a major part of the industry.
Yeah, no, that's 100% inevitable in hindsight. That is awesome. All right, so you know, speaking of that, what are your thoughts on crypto? I mean, obviously, I'm very biased. This is a NFT podcast, but I'd love to hear, like, do you think that is inevitable in hindsight, or was or is?
You know, it's very interesting because you know my son James, and I mean, starting when he was 15, 16 years old, 7 years ago or so, he was calling me an old man Luddite because I wasn't diving hard into crypto. And so I had a Bitcoin wallet, I'm going to say 2010 or 11, when I read about it in Wired magazine back then, and mined a few Bitcoin and then promptly forgot about it and just kind of put it away, just left it, right? And I thought it was interesting conceptually. The immutable aspect of it is fascinating. And the fact that it at least theoretically, cannot be manipulated, you know? And then the public nature of the confirmation of the blockchain is genius. So I think that many aspects of crypto are solutions in search of a problem right now, but that doesn't mean that it won't displace credit cards, for example, you know, which is a huge middle person, right? Like credit cards charge businesses something like 2.2 to 2.9%, 3.2% of every transaction. That's why they can give you free trips and everything, right? Well, as a business, I mean, nothing else is taking 3% of your business. So you put MetaMask and a bunch of Ethereum in your browser and you click a button and it's peer-to-peer, that feels inevitable because that 3% shouldn't exist, right? Like credit cards are a pretty old concept at this point, probably close to 100 years old. So I do think that there are massive uses for it. I think everything that you're working on is incredibly interesting. I also see a whole lot of, crap being tossed against the wall to see what sticks at this point. Like not everybody playing in the space has the best intentions. That's true of any new technology. I don't think that's disqualifying in any way. So I'm hardly an expert in crypto. I do have crypto. I have traded some crypto. I have invested in both crypto and NFTs. More to learn than to be hugely active in it. But, you know, I don't know if the crypto that wins the game has been invented yet. But no one knows that.
Yeah, so I want to ask you about Bitcoin. Like, you know, a lot of people say that, there's some people say that Bitcoin shouldn't have any value. It's kind of a Ponzi. Other people say that, no, there should be some sort of value that's disconnected from any government and that's, you know, fully digital. But I'd love to hear kind of your personal opinion on Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, look, people value all sorts of things that you know, historically, I mean, people used to trade in salt, right? Like anything can be a store of value so long as we agree upon it. And, you know, fiat currency, and I used to trade currencies, you know, are more fragile than people think. And I think our inflation right now and having printed $3 trillion, of course there's inflation right now. Like, that's inevitable. But the public generally doesn't understand that. And so, like, certain aspects of crypto are incredibly novel in that they're decentralized and immutable, which is the dream, of course. That's the whole point. Whether or not it becomes ubiquitous and easier to use probably has less to do with acceptance and more to do with, you know, what I mean by acceptance, philosophical acceptance by the public, it's more of just making it like way easier to use. You know, like people don't use technology until it's just brain dead. And, you know, crypto's not yet brain dead. Do you agree with that? I mean,
yeah, no, I think the biggest issue right now for crypto is the usability and wallets. And like, for example, my sister, she's 32. She's, you know, relatively tech savvy. I'd say she knows about, you know, the internet and computers and video games and whatnot. And she was trying to buy an NFT. This is like 6 months ago. And she said, Andrew, I've never had this many issues spending money. I want to spend $500 here, which is a lot of money, and I'm unable to do so because I don't understand what's going on. And that to me like really stuck with me. I was like, wow, we are very early. Like, because you know, if she wants to spend $500 and can't, like, there's a problem.
You know, when I put MetaMask on Chrome and transferred Ethereum in there, there's not a lot of use for it yet. You know, like there are places you can use that, and it actually makes it super easy. But I was instantly like, man, if this were more widespread, this is now easy. It's pretty brain dead, you know? The weird part about it, of course, is that, you know, if you have digital keys to your bank account and you screw it up, the bank's on the hook for it, you know, up to whatever the limit is. I forget the FDIC limit, $250,000 or something like that, right? So you can do a lot of stupid shit with your bank account and still feel like your money's safe, right? And yet, like, if you lose your pass code to your crypto wallet, you ain't getting back in. Now that's both a feature and a bug, right? It's a feature because, hey, it's secure. It's a bug because, well, it's maybe too secure for most people. You know, they're not gonna have cold storage, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like I remember like years ago when my son was literally putting, you know, he had some larger size crypto wallets and he was splitting it up into multiple wallets. And obviously he also put all of his pass keys into cold storage by literally stamping them onto metal and putting them in a safe. And I was like, okay, that's weird, you know? And he thought like, well, this is very normal because if I lose this, this, and this, or the computer goes, or like, you know, I forget this password. And I was like, yeah, I get that. But like, I don't need to do that for my bank because they have other ways of identifying me. Mm-hmm. And so I think like universal personal identification carries with it a whole bunch of privacy concerns. But, you know, and I'm talking about, you know, biometric or whatever. But at the same time, you know, those are the kinds of things that have been in banking for quite a long time that kind of work. That's the part that I think people who are the diehard, you know, crypto fans, like banking kind of works, you know? Fiat currency works. It does some things very poorly that can be improved upon, and it doesn't work perfectly in the digital world. But, you know, it's working pretty well. So as soon as those problems are solved, I see no reason why Bitcoin, Ethereum, you know, something else can't be as ubiquitous as the US dollar. And, you know, I think when that time comes, the US government is just going to make a digital dollar. I mean, they're already talking mm-hmm. about it, right? So like all the stable coins, like, well, you don't need a stable coin if you know, you've got a US dollar.
Definitely. Okay, so there's a lot of people out there that compare crypto to kind of the dot-com boom and bust, and they're saying, hey, listen, you know, we're still early. There's not a lot of, you know, too many use cases today, and you're right. It's kind of a solution looking for a problem. But in the future, you know, it's going to be used for so many things. It's going to be amazing, blah, blah, blah. Would you generally agree with that, or do you think that, no, we've already had, you know, over 10 years of Bitcoin and kind of blockchain technology broadly, still haven't had major adoption. So you know, what are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably the wrong person to ask, but my gut tells me that it's not going anywhere. You know, the technology is got so many people who are wildly bright and dedicated and investing massive amounts of money to making the technology better, usable, safe, secure, all those things. So, you know, I look at George Soros or even Taleb, who's, you know, he's written some wonderful books on trading and whatnot. You know, Fooled by Randomness is one of my favorite books ever, saying that, you know, Bitcoin's a Ponzi scheme and it's just going to end badly and all that. And, you know, he could be right, but he just sounds old to me. You know, like he just sounds like he's get off my lawn. I've already done my thing. And I'm somewhere in between the age of get off my lawn and trying to keep an open mind. And so, you know, I tend to think like I lived through the first dot-com bust. And my attitude was in 2001 and two, wow, there are some deals out there because the internet is not going anywhere. And in 2002, I invested in 5-6 companies that were nearly out of business, that were dot-com businesses, and exited profitably from all but one of those years later, 10 years later. Mm. So I think the same thing is likely to happen now. You know, when I was talking to my, James the other day, I was like, what do you make of the current, you know, crash in crypto? And he's like, I'm 22 years old and I've already seen this 5 times. So he's like, you know, like it's what I always taught him, and it's the old saying, like, you know, be greedy when others are scared, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I've actually put more money into crypto in the last week than I had in the last 10 years.
Wow.
Wow. So, I mean, you're never going to pick a bottom. And I'm not looking at a time horizon of months. I'm looking at a time horizon of 5 years. And like I said, you know, I could be wrong, of course. But then so are you, and so are a whole lot of other smart people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, and plus, damn it, it's just interesting, right? Like, mm-hmm. there's so many different things you could be working on. You know, within like the digital property and digital rights space, and think of publishing, like book publishing. So I publish books, right? And the kind of books I publish tend to be like large coffee table kind of stuff, right? They're not like informational books so much as they are like beautiful art pieces, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why wouldn't I sell both the digital rights to that along with the physical rights and then get paid again if someone decides to sell those digital copy? Like music and books and information, it wants to be free to move, but it doesn't necessarily need to be free from a currency standpoint, right? From a profitability standpoint. So I think those aspects of what you're doing are absolutely fascinating. And, you know, I mean, I remember the first time I saw someone spend money within a video game, and I just went, you know, for property, and I was mind blown. Like, I was mind blown. And so does that special cape in the video game have value? Well, to a lot of people, it does. So sure, why not?
Yeah. So, okay. Building off that, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on NFTs, because in my mind, crypto and NFTs are actually different. Yes, they're all, you know, they're all built on blockchain technology, but crypto kind of represents the financial system of the quote unquote metaverse, while NFTs represent more of the goods and services within that metaverse. So I'd love to hear your general take on NFTs and if you think NFTs are could be used. Yeah, just general take first, but if they could be used also in your business potentially.
Well, so I think what started our conversation was that there was a somewhat famous guy who I think is a bit of a grifter. I won't say who it is, but he's pretty famous. He's got a pretty good following. And grifters are going to grift, right? So he started an NFT restaurant, you know, raised the money and the memberships selling NFTs. And because he has such a big following, he raised, you know, I think it was over $10 million. And then, of course, you need to build a physical restaurant. Might be the worst way to... It's fast and dirty to raise money, but, like, those people are essentially buying tickets, just like we invented, not invented, but utilized within the restaurant industry in 2011 for Next Restaurant in Chicago. And we sold season subscriptions, prepaid. It's no different, but owning the digital rights to a physical, in-the-world... tangible thing where you're going to go eat, it's a solved problem 100 years ago. Like, the NFT doesn't bring anything new to that, right? And you go, well, yeah, you can sell it. Well, guess what? By law, if I sell you a ticket that is non-refundable, it is considered your property, just like an NFT. So if you buy a ticket to my restaurant and it's non-refundable, by law, it has to be exchangeable, meaning that you have the right to sell it to someone else. And some states have laws against scalping that and selling it for more. But, you know, if you sell it for the same amount, you have not broken any laws. And, of course, no one's going to find out if you sold it for double. So I looked at this, and a lot of press called me and said, what do you think about NFT for restaurants? And I'm like, it exists for digital goods and not an experience that you come eat at my restaurant. I can just... Talk already does that, you know, sufficiently well. It doesn't add anything to it. However, for things like music rights, book rights, you know, digital rights, it is fascinating and awesome.
So could you see yourself potentially in the future utilizing NFTs in some sort of manner that are involving your book rights or music rights or whatever that you're doing and building?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've looked at several companies that are doing just that. The part that feels right to me, without being an expert on it, is that it's very, very difficult to trace the property of anything digital as it moves through, you know, online universe, metaverse, whatever you want to call it. And so if you buy a copy of my book and you pass it on, having the ability to track that is incredibly valuable for the artist or the producer or whoever it may be, the original creator. And even if you don't get paid again on that, just knowing that that transaction's taken place is itself really wonderful. You know, if you're an author 15 years ago and you write a book and they send it out to a bunch of bookstores, you have absolutely no idea who your audience is. They give you a report every month saying, oh, you sold 1,200 books this month or 5,000 or whatever it may be. But you have no way to know who those people are. And I don't mean like, you know, Joe Smith at 1221 Briar Street or whatever, but you have no idea who your audience is and how big it is, and especially how big it is as that book may get passed from one person to another. So that traceability is in itself valuable. And then when you tie, you know, residual rights onto that that are built into the NFT itself, that's awesome. And I don't know how else you could possibly accomplish that. So that's something where the solution has found a problem and has solved it in a novel fashion, as opposed to a technology being applied to someone eating at a restaurant. Like, you just don't need it. It's like you're using a laser when a knife could do. So you don't need the laser, use the knife. The simplest solution is usually the best one. For digital rights of books, music, property, I mean, one of my things is like one of the biggest scams in the world is title insurance. You know, like you buy a house and you spend like a couple $1,000s on title insurance. And all that's doing is saying, yep, you really own that property. And then when you sell it, the title insurance company says, yep, we vouch and ensure that the guy actually owns it. And now we're going to pass that over to you. So Andrew, you're buying the house from me and this third party verifies it. And you know, they're getting thousands of dollars for title insurance. To me, that seems like, man, that is completely solvable with an NFT. I think that one's inevitable.
Yeah, no, I obviously agree with you. I think that NFTs for digital goods and assets is like a total no-brainer. The issue with physical goods is that the kind of the Oracle problem, which is kind of making sure the information about your book or about this data or whatever is accurately put on the NFT, accurately put on chain. That's really important. And then also custody, because right now, you know, as we talked about before, is like the custody of the stuff, like it's in my wallet. Like I could break my computer, I could lose my phone. And that's kind of an issue because you can't have your you know, housing title, you know, be on your phone and you break your phone. You can't call up the company and say, hey, can you guys reissue me another one? They're going to say, oh, no, we can see it on chain. It's still in your wallet. And you're like, oh, well, I can't access that anymore. So,
but you can imagine like there's definitely solutions to that.
Totally.
But even if there was a third party that sort of kept a copy of all the wallets in some way, right? But wasn't entitled to transfer thereof without approval. And, you know, you could do five-factor authentication on a human, you know, to give them the right to do it, but only two-factor for yourself. Like, it just seems to me that there's a middle person for a fit. I was trying to think of a physical good in the world where this process would dislocate the current folks that do it. And I can think of nothing bigger than title insurance.
Yeah, I mean, if someone set up, you know, the quote unquote Coinbase for property titles broadly, like that I think that would be a great company. But it would be centralized. But I think that it would be centralized for an obvious reason. Like you don't need that to be a completely decentralized ecosystem and whatnot. So I think that is a really compelling use case for sure.
So you know, like those are the things I think that will combine to utilize the technology in novel ways that you know, solve huge inefficiencies right now.
Yeah, so as a former trader and you know, current investor and many different things, what are your thoughts on the, you know, current market environment? And that's both with TradFi and also crypto.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that, again, you print $3 trillion and you have quantitative easing and you have the Fed propping up asset prices. And as they raise interest rates, the the stock in your market inflation going, you know, values going down is exactly what it's supposed to be doing. Like the Fed's never going to come out and say like, yes, it's very healthy for the S&P to go down 20%. It's very healthy for crypto to go down by, you know, 30, 40%. But the fact of the matter is that there was a lot of unsophisticated investors who were dumping money into companies based on valuations that, like, you know, they're never going to make enough money to pay back all the investors. Like, that much is certain. I'm not talking about, you know, some new altcoin or something. I'm talking about, you know, like major companies, you know. I didn't want to name names because I don't, you know, want to give opinions on investing. But, you know, like, you can't have a company with $50 million of profits worth $1 trillion. Like, that just makes no sense. So I think that it's inevitable. I think the Fed is unwinding things in a way where, hey, the market didn't crash 25% in a day in a panic. It's just going down 2 or 3% every day. And I think I've lived through that both in the panic sense and in the just, you know, normal bear market sense. And, you know, I kept a lot of money in cash over the last 2 years just waiting for this, which felt pretty inevitable.
Yeah, so my entry into markets broadly was in 2013 when I first got involved with Bitcoin. And so I view everything from kind of the crypto angle. And, you know, as I get older and I learn more about the traditional markets, I've discovered that, or what I think I've discovered is that the Fed has an insane amount of impact and essentially control over the market. And it is, you know, these are 12 unelected officials that kind of decide whether or not the U.S. economy goes up or down. That to me is like outrageous. But I would love to get your take. Do people know that, or is that incorrect, or, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
You said one thing that's very incorrect, which is you said that 12 unelected officials have, I think you used the word like control over the economy or influence over the economy, and they don't, you know, like monetary policy can only take you so far, right? And it's powerful, don't get me wrong. If you take interest rates down to nothing and print $1 trillion in, you know, 6 months, like, that will have very clear effects. And the unwinding of that also has clear effects. But they have a mandate, and their mandate is 2% annual inflation and stable markets that function as freely as possible. That's a pretty good mandate. And for, you know, 50 years or so, with a couple of major exceptions, it's worked really, really well. That said, what would the opposite of that be? I certainly don't want Congress deciding on that shit. I don't think there's too many bright economists in the halls of Congress. So, you know, like, I would rather we didn't live in a world of benevolent overlords, right? And you could decentralize everything. Having said that, I'm not quite sure how you set interest rate policy for a fiat currency without having people in charge.
Yeah, so I'm coming from the angle that, okay, I see that when the Fed raises rates, the markets go down, and then people get laid off from their jobs, and, you know, and then the economy kind of slows broadly. And then the opposite is true. You know, when they cut rates, you know, money's in plentiful supply. These companies are hiring people, and the economy kind of goes up. But you think that is incorrect? It's you know, that's not what's happening.
I mean, what you said is broadly correct, but also, you know, you have to go from the assumption of what is the proper mandate. You know, I mean, right now, largely unemployment as measured by the government is bizarrely low. And as someone who employs hundreds and hundreds of people, it's a very, very tight labor market, right? So from an individual standpoint, that may be very dissatisfying to hear that, right? But from the standpoint of 300 million humans in a country and trying to move the battleship around slowly so that, you know, people can move laterally between jobs and you can have overall growth but not too much inflation and, you know, things are doing as they should. Again, like, we've had a really good history of that with only a few giant lumps, right? And people would go like, well, yeah, it's corrupt officials or corrupt bankers, or, you know, we didn't have guardrails on in 2008. So that all those things are true, you know? I just don't know another system that's been invented in the history of humanity that's worked better so far. Like, you look at centralized governments. I mean, the economy in China right now is in shambles, you know? And, you know, it's very, very hard to be completely centralized. We're more decentralized than centralized in our markets.
Yeah, it's there's that saying. It's like we have the best of the worst systems or something like that. It's like, you know, it's like nothing is perfect, and people have tried a lot of different things, and so far what we're doing is working the best. It's not perfect by any means, but it's working effectively.
Like, yeah, and you know, if you look at like the big bankers who 5, 6, 8 years ago, whatever it may have been, were very anti-crypto and very dismissive publicly of the future of any crypto being viable. What are they doing? Well, they're investing hundreds of millions of dollars so that their credit cards can accept crypto and so that their banks can deal with it. They're just slow. So they're talking their own book in a trading perspective, right? Jamie Dimon was, you know, saying crypto was fool's errand and a Ponzi scheme. And they put hundreds of millions of dollars into building it out. So look what people do, not what they say, right?
Totally.
So they're one of the reasons why I think 10 years from now it will be more important than it is now is because of what the banks and credit cards and whatnot are actually doing, not what they're saying.
Yeah, so actually speaking of, you know, what these big banks and a lot of people are talking about and saying and even investing some money into, you know, metaverse, that's been a big term that people have been throwing around for the past year. And so what is your take? Like, what is the metaverse and what do you think about it?
Well, I'm 54 years old, which is hard for me to believe, but man, I remember when Mondo 2000 was a magazine and Jared Lanier was talking about that. That was 30 years ago, right? I was 20 years old and going like, you know, virtual reality. Like, I remember the first time I put on a virtual reality headset. It was huge and it had a backpack. And man, that was a long time. That was Tron days, right? And, you know, change comes slowly and then all at once, right? So people my age are dismissive of the metaverse because we've been hearing about it for 30 years. And then you put on the first Oculus and you're like, wow, this has come a long way, but, you know, still not quite there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Same thing with AI, same thing with all this stuff. And then all of a sudden you see something and it crosses that chasm into a wow factor. So for me, that literally happened yesterday. The coolest thing I have seen in 30 years is DALL-E 2. The OpenAI project for text to image generation. And their first version a couple years ago was interesting, but not terribly useful. Yesterday I got access to DALL-E 2 and I couldn't sleep last night. Like, it's genuinely mind blowing. So how does that relate to your question? Well, right now the metaverse for someone like me still isn't much, you know, other than a lot of speculation, a lot of talk. Certainly, you know, visited, you know, with the newest Oculus, you know, different games, different meeting rooms, chat rooms. I've been privy to some private beta stuff that's super cool, but it's not anything yet that I would want to do every day or even every week, you know. But you know, at some point it crosses into something which becomes incredibly useful. And I, you know, and it happens very slowly, and then one day you wake up and it's there. And I think that's what's going to happen with everything that you're working on.
Yeah, the metaverse is a very nebulous concept. It's kind of like saying internet. And for me, the metaverse is just like the internet with ownership. And that, the best way to have digital ownership just so happens to be blockchain. So I feel like they're very intertwined. And I feel like it has less to do with the level of immersion and more about the transformation that comes with that ownership of digital goods. And yeah, I do think that if you look at like macro, like, you know, in terms of our trends, it's like screen time is just up and to the right. Like that's across every country. People are glued to their TVs, phones, computers. And then when you combine that trend of just people are always online or always connected with NFTs and blockchain, that's when you get like the quote unquote metaverse. But yeah, it's really cool that you're seeing that some kind of new emerging technologies that relate to that. So,
yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think I take it more literally than that. You've abstracted it in a more intelligent way. I tend to have that more romantic notion of a place that you go because I think that people want that. Right. You want the Star Trek holodeck kind of thing, right?
Totally.
And so you're right intellectually, but the thing that's going to grab people emotionally is an experience that they can't get any other way.
Love it. All right. So what are you focused on today? I mean, besides talk, like what do you spend your time thinking about and doing?
Oh God, you know, a lot of talk, a lot of getting the restaurants back fully running. And then, you know, beyond that, you know, I'm trying to mentor younger entrepreneurs right now. I get a lot of incoming emails from people who are starting businesses. And, you know, after starting so many businesses in diverse industries, like you were asking about, I kind of feel like I've got some cheat codes now, you know, like I know how to do the block and tackle of the things to get something going and to experiment in a way to see if it has some traction, right? A lot of those things are not skills that I had even when I was running the trading firm when I was in my 20s. And so those skills are, I think, transferable, whereas a desire to be entrepreneurial probably is not, if that makes sense.
Awesome.
So I'm doing a lot of that, and I'm writing a bit again, which is nice. I haven't had the luxury to do it in the last couple of years. And so now I'm on a weekly basis writing some things and just working on a couple projects that I can't really talk about yet that are pretty wild and have come to me just like because I'm willing to let people knock on the door, open it and hear them out. So yeah, like a lot of stuff, but also trying to, you know, enjoy myself a little bit. I think the last couple of years have been very difficult and trying on us all. And, you know, it's been fun. I'm going to hear some live music tonight for the first time in a long time. So all good stuff.
Love it. Awesome. All right, Nick. Well, this has been a absolutely stellar conversation, but time for the closing questions. All right. What are you bearish on?
Wow. That's so funny. Like no one's ever asked me that. you know, nothing's coming to mind. Doesn't that sound weird?
That's you're an optimist. That's amazing.
But I'm not. That's why it's so. You know, I don't know the answer. I feel like as soon as we end, I'm gonna go, oh crap, a lot of things. You know.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. So I'm bearish on politics in this country. You okay. know.
Fair.
I think that's a very common answer, but it's one that I don't see getting better anytime soon unless we have a leader arrive. A nice leader is a bad word, but an inspirational character in our country that can serve to somehow unify people. But I have to say that, you know, the things that make us similar are far greater than the things that divide us. Mm-hmm. That said, everything's amplified right now. And even myself on a daily basis, I see things, I read things, events happen in the world. And overall, historically, if you look at the long term, last 300 years, humanity's never been in a better place. Mm-hmm. That said, we are definitely in a cycle of hopefully short-term, near-term decline. And, you know, politics right now is attracting just the worst of all of us, in my opinion, both sides of the aisle. Like there are some genuine morons on both sides of the aisle.
Totally.
And I understand why. Like, the smart people I know do not want to run for office and put themselves through that. But can you imagine being in Congress and having to argue with some of those people, like, on the record?
Miserable. Miserable.
Like, right. I mean, so, you know, I'm incredibly bearish on that. And I don't know, I don't want to be, I guess, but that's what sprung to mind. It's not a novel answer. I think a lot of people feel that way.
Love it. All right. What are you bullish on?
You know, I have to say that a lot of things. I believe that the promise of digital innovation and pace of digital innovation is continuing as it has for, you know, for forever, really. And we are at an inflection point that is truly, truly interesting, and also, you know, not predictable. So, but I'm very bullish on all of that. And I mean that broadly. You know, I think AI is way farther along than people think and give credit for. And over the next 5 years, some things are gonna come out that are just mind blowing, like magic.
Awesome. All right, what do people misunderstand about you?
You know, there's been some press and whatnot that they write where, you know, over the years I've had like two or three public controversial confrontations with like customers of the restaurants or whatever. And in each of those cases, I was not picking a fight to defend myself. I was trying to support our team and our employees. And so, you know, I don't want to suffer fools. And if they make it public, then I just try to have the receipts and bury them, you know. But I'm not antagonistic. I'm passionate. I will argue with people, but I'm wrong half the time. And I'd like to think that I can admit when I'm wrong. And so I'm less obstinate, less of a jerk than people think.
I love that. I love that. Awesome. All right.
I guess what I'm saying is I deeply care about our teams, the people in my life, the people who've helped me get there, and I'm incredibly thankful.
Of course. All right. What was your biggest failure, and what did you learn about that experience?
You know, that's interesting. I have been asked this a few times, and my wife will tell you that I have a very short memory for failure. I do love golf, and I grew up near a golf course, and I started playing at a public golf course when I was a kid. And golf is a great game of failure. And I remember Jack Nicklaus was asked exactly that question: what are the worst shots you've ever hit? And he drew a blank. You know, he was like, I don't know. As soon as I hit a shitty shot, I work really hard to forget it. And then I imagine and remember the great shots so that I can keep that in mind next time I'm playing. And man, I got to tell you, I took that to heart as a trader. And so I have made some just miserably stupid trades. And what I learned from those miserably stupid trades, and there were many of them, is that the old saying, cut your losses, is real. But more than that, you buy your position every day. So when you wake up in the morning, whatever positions you have on, whether that be an investment or your marriage or whatever it is, the choice that you make to stay in the same position, to do nothing, is a choice. You bought that position again. You stayed where you are, right? And so I think I learned mostly, even when it's hard to see, that when you realize that you shouldn't be in that position anymore, you simply change. You cut that loss. And occasionally, and I don't want to be specific about this, but occasionally you misfire on something and it requires someone else to tell you, hey, remember how you told me to cut your losses and you buy your position every day? Well, you're not doing it right now. So my wife told me that a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And she was right. So I changed really quick. And so I think, I don't want to be specific on that particular failure, but at the end of the day, you know, that's all it is. Like, you just have to like go, well, you know, I'm going to bat 52% if I'm lucky.
Amazing. Wow, that was incredible. All right, last question. How do you define success?
Defining what you want to accomplish and then iterating as you go.
Amazing. Nick, this was just an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for doing this. I feel like I just went through like a philosophy class and also a business course at the same time. It was amazing. And if people want to find out more about yourself, find out more about what you do, where should they go? What should they do?
I'm on Twitter, Nick Kokonis, Instagram, N Kokonis. And I'm Nick at TalkHQ. If you got something cool, just email me. That's actually my email.
Amazing. Nick, thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
Hey, everyone. Stay tuned for more episodes of the ZemaRed podcast and subscribe to the ZemaRed newsletter for more info on all things NFTs. Thanks so much for listening.